And the always lovely Ronnie Spector, covering the Beach Boys' Don't Worry, Baby. I began the show tonight talking about Donald Jeffrey's new book, Survival of the Richest, how the corruption of the marketplace and the disparity of wealth created the greatest conspiracy of all. And the book is just chock full of what can only be described as bleak and dire statistics regarding the economic inequality in America. I thought I'd share a few more with you. U.S. families with a head of household under the age of 30. Let me repeat that. U.S. families with a head of the household who is under the age of 30 have a 37% poverty rate. Half of all children in cities like Miami, Cleveland, and Detroit are now living in poverty. Half of all children. The poorest residents of Miami live on $11 per day. U.S. cities like Miami, Atlanta, and New Orleans have a higher income inequality rate now than Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro and are on par with Mexico City. It goes on and on. More than a million students in U.S. public schools are now homeless. How did this happen? Was it simply the forces of globalization and automation, or was there something more sinister afoot? Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest, joins me next, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Richard Serrett coming to you from Coast's Toronto affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. Donald Jeffries has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-1970s, when he was a teenage volunteer for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. He's very active on all the JFK assassination forums and has been a moderator on the London Spartacus Education Forum for several years. His first published book, the acclaimed 2007 novel The Unreals, has been compared to Alice in Wonderland and The Wizard of Oz. Hidden History was his first nonfiction book. His latest is Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Don Jeffries, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Harry. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. I'd like you to drill down a little bit more and talk to me some more about these dire and bleak statistics which illustrate how deep this economic divide is in America. I've mentioned several throughout the course of the evening thus far, but one of the things I picked up on in your book is because of this disparity, you can no longer even consider the United States to be classed among the first world developed nations because of this disparity. Talk to me more about that.
That's exactly right. These statistics show that we're slowly, at least for most of this, and again, I use that 80-20% split quite a bit, and we see that in all the research where you have, of course, the 1% at the top that has unfathomable wealth, but the top 20% is doing well. Those are the people that typically will tell you, hey, you know, work harder, you know, and fine, because the system's working for them, and they're basically running the system for the 1%. But it's about 80% of us that are either living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, what's the recent statistic that found 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings? I mean, just think of that. That's a minor medical emergency, you know, thing away from the financial devastation. And that's the reality. And, of course, we have, you know, 94 to 100 million adults age Americans who are out of work. Somehow that adds up to a 5% unemployment rate. I don't know how that works, but it's common core math, I guess. But we have this kind of inequality we haven't seen. As Naomi Klein has said recently, we're witnessing a massive transfer of wealth. It's unprecedented, and it's all going up. It's not. There's no more trickling down. It's going upwards at warp speed, and it's going more and more to the hands of the people at the top who already have it. And as I show it, and I try to show in this book, it's not only. It's the way our society is structured now, where the people, not only is all the wealth at the top, but all the perks and all the benefits, all the freebies, they all go to the people who don't need them. As I was amazed even myself at doing this research that, you know, for instance, most people don't realize poor people pay more for car insurance. something like that. And it's, even if they have a better driving record, and it's just, you have to read the book to find out how all this works. But it's, and that's because the system, as Donald Trump has said, you know, back when he was running a different kind of campaign, he said the system is rigged, and the system is rigged. Maybe not in the way he meant it, but the system is rigged against that 80%. And I think that's what I show. The statistics are just overwhelming. And of course, this is global as well. I believe it's down to the 62 richest people in the world, I believe, have more wealth than the bottom half of the world or something. It's just, it's incomprehensible. So it's not just in America, but America was insulated for a long time. And now, now because of the effect of we've gutted industry here, so we don't have good jobs anymore, we don't have factories. And all those people that used to work in the factories who were not college students, they have nowhere to go now. They're still here. I mean, every generation has people. You know, not everybody's going to be a scholar, but we haven't prepared for that. Instead, we have the politicians giving the same tired rhetoric about education and things like that, when in fact the value of the education is diluted with each college degree. And as I show in the book there, a college education is basically for the rich. 77% of those in the upper quadrille, the richest, the wealthiest quadrille of Americans, graduate from college. Only 9% in the bottom quadrille do. Only 10% from the bottom half of Americans go to the top 146 colleges in America. And those are the ones that really get you the gravy jobs. Most, you know, most colleges, now what they do, it's they have... what they've done is they've lowered standards across the board in education, as well as our college degree has been diluted, so that if you get a degree, unless you're one of those top colleges, which, again, only the wealthy really go to, then you're going to be given a job that used to only require a high school degree. And it's probably going to pay you less than they used to pay the high school, the person with the high school degree. So it's an awful situation. And this book was a work of passion, because I feel very passionately about it, and I think it's the biggest problem in the United States and around the world, and we absolutely have to do something about it, unless we're just going to go back to the point where we just, people are going to be dropping dead in the streets because they don't have anything to eat, they can't get health care, they don't have housing or whatever.
So in many regards, it's worse than the Great Depression. When you have 76% of the U.S. population, this to me is unfathomable. 76% of the U.S. population is living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And that's what that is. It's, we've just seen within the last, oh, I don't know, the numbers vary, but let's say the last 30 years or so. I think this transformation began in the 80s with Reaganomics, where you know, people were ranting about government, and we started to see with the air traffic controller strike, where that was the death knell of unions. And even though I've been a union guy, and I used to, you know, I certainly used to decry with my heroes of the Kennedys, and they became famous for showing the links between no organized crime and unions. So we know there were a lot of unions that were corrupt, but the presence of viable unions back then lifted the wages of all the non-union jobs. And once those unions began to be crippled in the 80s, organized labor, I mean, people won't remember, but it hasn't been all that long ago, organized labor was a big deal in the Democratic Party. George Meany and leaders like that, they wielded a great deal of power, but they're crippled now, and that's because, as I go into a great deal in my book, in the immigration, for instance, because labor is considered to be on the left, and Democrats typically used to court their support, they can't talk about immigration and the devastating impact that immigration has had on wages and benefits, because to do so is politically incorrect, and the left is just completely sworn to political correctness. So as it stands right now, big labor has become completely ineffectual. You don't even hear talk about it. I mean, when they talk about who's not like they did back in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s, where we talk about, you know, who's big labor supporting and we have to court their vote. Nobody cares about that anymore, because they know labor has become, other than the unions that still exist for government workers, they're pretty good. But in private industry, unions, you know, except for professional athletes and things like that, they really, I mean, if they exist, they're very ineffectual. And that's just one part of the aspect of all this. But I believe that got the ball rolling. And then we have the incredible greed. I mean, the term CEO if you look back, you really didn't start hearing the term CEO until the 80s or so, again, the 80s. And back in, you know, before that, the president of a company typically might have made, you know, 20, 30 times, maybe even say 50 times what his employees made. Now you're talking about 350 times, and it's, you know, so far ahead of any other country in the world that does it this way. And it just makes no sense. But the CEOs we have now, the upper management we have now, they're just grabbing more and more. And if you talk to a lot of citizens who are at the bottom, they somehow, that doesn't bother them as much as whether their neighbor is, you know, buying a beer with food stamps or something. That's what they get upset about. And that's what, in this book, I'm trying to, you know, redirect their rage in the right place. You know, don't be mad at somebody that has a big screen TV that you think doesn't have enough money for that. You know, be mad at the local sports team owner that raped the taxpayer to have his new stadium built completely with taxpayer funds and more welfare than you're gonna, than anybody you know is getting.
You spend a little bit of time, I'll point out, remind listeners, Donald Jeffries is with us. The book is Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. You spend some time in the book talking about CEOs and the bonuses they receive. Just walk us through some of the examples. This, I mean, was really sort of exemplified during the crash in 2008 when a lot of these banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, and others were receiving, you know, billions of dollars in bailouts, and yet they were still giving these huge bonuses to their CEOs in the tens of millions of dollars.
Exactly, and that's, as I believe I have all the stats in there for that. That they learned, they certainly didn't practice any kind of financial penny pinching afterwards. They went, you know, they basically whooped it up and gave each other high fives and gave each other bigger bonuses than ever before. And this is, you know, criminal. You know, again, when people talk about welfare cheats, I mean, here we had the welfare on an unimaginable scale where the taxpayers, and then not only did they bail out the banks, and then as I pointed out in the book, I showed you from several articles, the mainstream media and the bankers themselves tried to blame the people who were foreclosed on and had to default their loans, blame them for being irresponsible for taking out the loans. As if the average person on the street is responsible for knowing whether or not he qualifies for a loan. They're the ones that gave them the loans. They said they qualified. So, yeah, maybe they should have had enough common sense to know they couldn't afford it. But, you know, things happen, and they didn't take any responsibility. And that's what is so amazing, whether it's sports team owners or the big banks. When they experience any kind of a blip or any kind of a problem, they come running to the taxpayers, and we're supposed to bail them out and help them out. But if an individual, and goodness knows we have individuals all over the country that are suffering on a scale that hasn't been seen since the Great Depression, they don't get a bailout. But they're told, hey, you know, buddy, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no handout. I mean, the cliches are endless. But and that's, again, that's what's so wrong about it. And the people at the bottom who, many of them struggling from paycheck to paycheck, they have the attitude, well, they will side with the 1%. they will be more upset about, you know, somebody on welfare than they will be on, you know, the local sports team owner that's getting a stadium built with funds, or Walmart, whose general orientation includes instructing their new employees on how to apply for welfare and food stamps because they pay them so little that they qualify. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that should infuriate, especially the people that are struggling, but it doesn't. And that's what's difficult trying to get through to people, is that they don't see the big picture. And they, I don't know, because it's, you know, somebody in the 1%, those people are so far beyond their reach, maybe they don't even seem real to them, whereas they're, the people they see at the store with food stamps are obviously real. And they're all struggling, so they don't want to, you know, they don't want them getting a leg up in the rat race. They think they're getting some kind of a handout. But, you know, we absolutely have to do something. And as I pointed out about the the banks, not only do they give each other incredible bonuses after they get handoffs, but if we look at the way the corporate world works, all this is supposedly gets market-driven, the sacred marketplace, the market's always right. But as we see over and over again, failed CEOs who fail miserably are rewarded, and often they're given these awful golden parachutes. Carly Fiorina was just one of them. I believe she got a $40 million golden parachute to go away after she completely bungled her job with HP. And we see this over and over again. I mean, it's almost every week you can see new examples. I tried to update the book as much as I could, but you can probably next week have more examples, and after the book is published, you'll have even more.
It's coming at you too fast. Yeah, another one here you mentioned, the CEO of Goldman Sachs. This is back in 2008. Lloyd C. Blankfein was given over $70 million in total compensation, despite his company having been gifted $10 billion in the bailout. J.P. Morgan Chase's James Dimon earned nearly $28 million, while his company had taken $25 billion from the taxpayers. One of the worst examples, I'll say worst, is John Welch of General Electric. This wasn't a buyout or anything. He was given $417 million in honor of his 20-year tenure at General Electric. $417
million. I believe I quoted, I love to look at the Internet, and they said, there's so many anonymous souls out there in forums and stuff that give you pearls of wisdom you can't get anywhere else. And somebody, I don't know if it was in relation to that, but one of the stats I wrote, he said something like, I, at this rate, I would have to work 12 centuries or something at my present salary to make that kind of money. And that's the kind of figures that we're talking about. The average salary in America is about $44,000 a year. And, you're looking at the average CEO is $22 million or something like that. The difference there is ridiculous. There's nobody that's worth thousands of more than any other human being. There's nothing. And as I think I prove conclusively in the book, is a whatever talent, and we hear all this executive talent, which can't be quantified. You can't measure it. They're not running a 40-yard dash or doing a high jump. There's no way to quantify this. We're just told that they have this unquantifiable talent. Well, we have to, and they'll even defend the outrageous salaries and compensation package. Say, you have to pay for talent. What is executive talent exactly? I mean, it's from a layman, what I see is that it's being exceptionally good at getting money, and especially the ones around the CEO, it's exceptionally good at brown-nosing, attending meetings, and nodding and saying, yeah, that's right, JR, great, that kind of thing. That's what I believe the talent is not rocking the boat so that you get your share of the gravy train. I don't see any fantastic talent there. If the people at the top of the list, and we talk about, I believe I wrote something in the book along the lines of, if the Bill Gateses and Warren Buffetts of the world, if they had developed a cure for cancer or extended life expectancy significantly, then they would probably be worth all the billions we could come up with. But none of these people at the top of the list have accomplished anything really significantly. I mean, Warren Buffett has never done anything but be an investor. Really, he's done well at investing, and like most of these people, he started out well in life. His father was a United States congressman. Bill Gates, his father was, we're told this myth that he came from the middle class. His father was a president of Planned Parenthood. His mother sat on all the boards of directors of companies back in, the 50s when most women were at home baking cookies. And he comes from a long line of vice presidents as far as his grandparents and so forth. He's only middle class in this mythological fantasy where somebody like that is middle class along with somebody that's making $50,000 a year. There's a huge difference there, but they kind of lump everyone together to make a lot of people who are struggling paycheck to paycheck feel like, you're middle class. Bill Gates was middle class, and look what he did. And that's the problem I have is with it. If they were doing something that valuable, the people at the top, then I think none of us would begrudge the fortune. But as far as that they have, but I can't see all the examples that I list in the book of the richest people in the world. They don't appear to me to be good at anything except being good at accumulating great wealth.
All right, we'll take a time out, Don, or as one Washington talk show host called it, the vice president of looking out the window. We'll come back. Don Jeffries, Survival of the Richest. Here are the Beatles taking us into the break with a very unappreciated or underappreciated tune called Hey Bulldog on Coast to Coast AM. Sly, if you want me to stay. The first person to have a double hand transplant in the UK has told of his joy at being able to hold a pen to write a letter of thanks to his surgeon. Chris King says he's now able to write, hold a mug of tea, and clap the achievements of his favorite sports team. Bigger strides than he ever believed he would following the groundbreaking operation 9 months ago. The 57-year-old says it feels like he's getting his life back on track, all thanks to consultant plastic surgeon Simon Kay. It's a great story and some remarkable photos to go along with it of Chris's new hands. You'll find that story up at the coasttocoastam.com website in the In the News section. Over the weekend, in anticipation of my doing this show, I received an email from a listener out in Newfoundland saying he wants to stay up and listen, but Newfoundland is a further half hour ahead of the Atlantic time zone, which means, he said, he'd have to stay up until 2:30 in the morning before Coast to Coast begins. He says, I can't do it. Well, there's a real simple fix. A subscription to the Coast Insiders Club. You can listen to the previous night's show the next morning or anytime. For around 15 cents a day, you get over 1,800 past Coast to Coast shows for immediate download, a high-quality live broadcast, podcasts, automatic downloads of current shows via iTunes or our Android and iPhone apps, as well as access to our twice-monthly live chat sessions. So there you go, Newfoundland. Every one of you, join the Coast Insiders Club. Problem solved. When we come back, more of my conversation with Donald Jeffries, author of Survival of the Richest, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Donald Jeffries stays with us, author of Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. The term one-percenter gets bandied about so often. What is actually, what's the minimum annual income to get into that club, to be a one-percenter?
I think the bottom tier is like $250,000 a year. But like we were talking about the middle class, there's obviously a huge difference between a Bill Gates middle class and most middle class people. There's a huge difference between somebody making $250,000 a year and somebody with 40, 50, 60 billion, 70 billion, like the richest people in the world. Or I don't really talk too much about the Rothschilds in the book, for instance, or even the Rockefellers, but collectively their wealth dwarfs all the one percenters. I don't even think, because they kind of remain in the shadows, especially the Rothschilds. Nobody can even imagine how many billions they have. But when we talk about this, there's a great deal of difference between the 1%. But I when I think of the 1%, I think of the someone with at least, you know, 500 million, I would think, something like that, and certainly
right.
Billionaires.
Because we're not, the $250,000 threshold, a lot of small to medium-sized business people who,
right.
You know, work a lot, and they did start from nothing. The classic immigrant story of someone who comes to this country with $50 in their pocket, gets off the boat at Ellis Island, and starts churning out pizzas, you know, earns enough to open his own pizza store. Then he opens another one. I mean, there are those stories. And they continue to this day. So the $250,000, because what I was getting at is that, you know, Bernie Sanders, I mean, he really made his bones in the last election railing against the one percenters. But when you look at his income as a senator, his wife's income as a college administrator, they're one percenters. Isn't that more than a little hypocritical?
Right. Elizabeth Warren's made some of the same comments too. Yeah, it is. And that's one of the, I think one of the main points of my book is that anybody, and this is the reason why nothing ever changes, is because anybody with a public platform, I mean, there are people like me that have this platform that can go on radio shows and things like that, but I don't have the kind of platform that a politician has or kind of platform where I can go on, national television, things like that. And anybody with a platform like that, whether it's a politician, whether it's obviously any kind of business leader or any mainstream media talking head, they're all going to be, most of them are making more than $250,000 a year. So they're going to be part of the 1% or at least in that top 20%. So the problems they talk about when they seek legislation, when they seek solutions, it's always with their status in mind. And so when they, like Bernie Sanders, one of the things he talked about early in his campaign was increasing the payroll tax. Well, most people don't realize the payroll tax, one of the many ways the system works against it at 80%, it only taxes the first $119,000 of income, the first. So that means that the Bill Gates of the world is paying on $119,000, is the same amount as somebody making $119,000 pays. It's crazy, and it's one of the reasons why Social Security has an $11 shortfall, and they won't even talk about taxing all income for Social Security purposes, which would help to alleviate the problem, as well as means testing. Because, you know, Ross Perot, during his 1992 campaign, tried to bring up voluntary means testing, and they shouted him down, all the lobbying groups, and he said, I don't need Social Security. But this is the kind of thing that the problem we face is that anybody with a public platform, the people making the decisions, because we pay our politicians so well, because there's no term limits, and so they stay in power long enough to accumulate great wealth. I think Dianne Feinstein is her husband's a billionaire or something. It's ridiculous how much money she has. And there are lots of politicians like that. They're accumulating wealth at a far greater level than what they're the income that they make yearly would indicate, but of course they have speaking fees and just outside interests and things like that. But so the average person, I have a section in the book on the Hattis Hour, you know, affluence means influence, where we just don't have any influence. The people that run things, who make legislation, who make laws, who make rules, they don't listen to that 80%. So everything, that's why you hear all these continual calls for sacrifice. And when they're talking about sacrifice, they mean that 80%, the people that really can't sacrifice anymore. But the people at the top simply won't sacrifice at all. And that's why you don't hear about means testing for Social Security, which they don't even need. It's pocket change for them. But this is standard operating procedure, and it's just the way they work. One of the chapters I have in the book is how they all give themselves part-time income, where they all have part-time jobs. They all sit. I couldn't believe when I was examining these board of directors that they have, virtually every company has. It's amazing how you see the same suspects. Basically, they sit on each other's boards of directors, and they make an unbelievable amount of money, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 a year for a really part-time job. Al Gore is getting $633,000 a year to attend four meetings for Apple. Now, just think of that. Who could? We're talking about the worth. You know, they try to tell McDonald's or workers or fast food workers that they're not worth $15 an hour, or nobody is. You can't raise the minimum wage. But Al Gore and people like that are worth $633,000 to attend four meetings. That's some special meetings, and that's what those numbers are throughout my book, and it's the way things really are. And people just don't consider the numbers are staggering. The book was actually much thicker. They really edited it down because the numbers, there's still a lot of them in there, but the examples and the numbers are just endless. And it's just, you know, I guess they didn't want me to hit the reader over the head too much with it, but really you can look in depth and just see the extent of the problem is unbelievable. And as I said, one of those things that people don't look at are these boards of directors, where this part-time income is more than 99%. Basically, the part-time income puts these guys most often in a 1% level, where if they didn't have a full-time job, they would be 1%ers doing that. And a lot of them are also retirees, and they still sit on board of directors, and I talk about all the consulting fees they make. So there's ways where they're still making 1% money after they've retired. And, of course, they already have magnificent pensions. There's a guy from Honeywell he's probably going to make more now, but as of a few years ago, he's scheduled to make over $700,000 a month when he retires. Now, based on, you know, the average American worker's salary, you're talking about working close to 20 years full-time to get what that guy's going to make in 1 month,
right,
when he retires.
Right.
And it's just, that's just too huge a disparity, and everyone should understand that.
You do see a lot of, up here in Canada, for example, a lot of ex-premiers of provinces, even prime ministers, find their way on to, let's say, the board of directors for American Express, or something like that. And then the question is, you know, what did they do for that reward? You start to have to ask yourself that question. Why did Al Gore get named to the Apple board? Was it for a wink and a nod, or was it just because Al Gore has access and influence? What's the trade-off?
Yeah, well, I think the way it works, the way it looks to someone like me, looking at the outside, you know, like George Carlin's at the big club. And
you're breaking up there a little bit, Don.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll get you to back up there again.
Okay, I said, you know, as George Carlin said, it's a big club and we ain't in it. So from somebody who's not in the club, it looks to me like they're just greasing each other's palms, and this is the way where they reward each other. Hey, I'll let you sit on my board of directors and give you $200,000. You let me sit on yours. And that's what we see if you analyze who are on these boards of directors. I mean, there's people, I believe Vernon Jordan at one time was on 10 different boards of directors. Now, even if you assume they're doing real work, just think of how there's the most talented, magnificent person in the world couldn't handle 10 jobs at one time. Effectively, it's impossible. And I list a bunch of the politicians. There was one retired congressman. It's, he's on, I forget how many, but he was making like $600,000 a year sitting on three or four different boards of directors, and in addition to his lucrative pension, which is better than obviously almost all of the citizens are going to get out there in the private sector, because they're basically eliminating pensions in the private sector.
But is this the fault of capitalism? I mean, Karl Marx sort of, you know, predicted that this was the ultimate result of capitalism. When you take it to its, you know, the conclusion, this is the end of capitalism. But I don't see this, what's going on right now, as true free market capitalism. I don't think capitalism is to blame here.
No, I think there's a huge difference between free enterprise, which is a great thing and did work pretty well in America. I mean, there were always problems with it. There were always too many poor people. But the disparity of wealth wasn't there, you know, until the 80s and 90s when it really kicked in. But I think there's a huge difference in what we see there. And what we have today is predatory capitalism, crony capitalism, where we see these kind of things where you sit on my board of directors, I'll sit on yours, and they just reward each other. Even with celebrities and people like that, they do things that don't even make any sense. For instance, I listed several times we looked in there where you looked at the bonuses that a company paid out, and if these are all based on the sacred marketplace, how do you give out more bonuses than your company made in profit that year? And I have examples of that in the book. That makes no sense. And they would tell a worker that they would quote that kind of marketplace mantra to you. Same way they reward celebrities, again, more one percenters, where there's a poll in there, I was even shocked at it, where they ran a poll and it was something like 96% of the respondents said they didn't want to see celebrities endorse anything. And they've done other polls that show when celebrities endorse something, the product sells less well than when they don't. And yet we continue to see companies, the same CEOs, promote this. Well, we have to get this guy who's already rich, you know, we have to give him great big money to talk for 2 minutes about a product that their own research shows isn't going to sell as well. And I think it's because it's the club, as George Carlin talked about. They're all in the club, and they just want to keep rewarding each other. And there's something about the way that 1% works where they just enjoy giving things. And Americans, you know, typically enjoy. We love this winner-take-all thing, you know, where Americans hate ties, they hate, they love the idea of one guy winning, they love dynasties in sports, they love the same people and the same teams winning over and over again, and I think that's one reason why they don't protest too much when they see the same people reaping rewards and getting freebies and so forth, the kind of things I talk about in the book, because it kind of fits in with their,
that's the American dream, right? Yeah, because if I work hard enough, that'll be me.
Yeah, and as I show, there's very little upward mobility in America. You can see that the research shows that if you're born at the bottom of the ladder, you have some chance, but not that much of a chance of even reaching the middle class, and you have almost no chance of reaching the upper class. And if you're a middle class, you don't have that much chance of reaching the upper class. Certainly not the 1%. And, we would like to believe that it exists, and certainly there are exceptions, and I'm sure I'll hear from plenty of people, I did this, and that's what you get from people, I did this, and my kid did this, and okay, that's great, and I'm not saying it never happens, but the statistics show out, when you have 77% of the people in the students coming up from the top quarter wealth-wise are college graduates, and only 9% from the lowest quarter are 77-9. That's a disparity that's almost mind-boggling. And so if everything is based, if almost every job now requires a college education, what does that mean for everybody, basically everyone, or the other 9%, 91% of the people in that lowest quarter? It means they're going to stay mired in that bottom corner, unless maybe they're lucky and they can play basketball or football or something. But again, that's so few that it's negligible.
And well, you're talking about professional sports. Right. When you talk about the club, now here's a sacred cow, the National Football League, hugely successful, generates tens of billions of dollars in revenue. And yet, this I didn't realize. They have this special tax exemption because they are considered non-profit? How does that work?
Exactly. And that's, again, because the people at the top write the codes for themselves. They write the tax laws. That's how GE, under John Welch, mentioned earlier, I guess maybe he deserved the $400-some million because they paid no taxes at all 1 year, and a couple other years they didn't pay any taxes. Donald Trump, we know, didn't pay taxes for several years. There, I have a book in there, a stat in the book there, something like, God, I want to say, I don't remember the numbers. There's so many numbers, but I think it was 30-some thousand Americans that made over $200,000 a year. I think it was 2009, one of those years, paid no taxes, income taxes at all. And how does that happen? But it's because the more money you make, the more loopholes you can get, the system works for you. And you'll find as you, I mean, I don't know, I'm nowhere near the top of the system, but I can see by studying this that the higher you go up the ladder, the less obstacles you encounter to accumulating more wealth. And the rules and the laws are written for you. So you open another door, and you get that. Oh, now I get that. And it's the way it works. So when you eventually get to the top, it's, as I said, especially for celebrities that make it, it's literally possible for them to walk around all day with no wallet, nothing, and get everything for free. Walk into a restaurant, sure, you know, it's a local porch chair. You eat here for free, no problem. Your money's no good here, Mr. So-and-so. That's the kind of stuff we get. And, of course, that's, you know, I realize celebrities are kind of in a category by themselves, but it's how we treat average people and, again, how we treat these special people. And then, of course, the people that aren't celebrities that have even more wealth than them, the John Welches of the world, the guy that I can't remember his name that's getting $700,000 a year when he retires from Honeywell, those kind of people. These are the kind of people that remain in the shadows and aren't exactly celebrities, but their wealth, again, they're making more money in a couple months than most people will make in their lifetimes, and that's just wrong. As Eugene Debs, you know, said a long time ago, you know, riches, it's the savings of many in the hands of a few, and you don't have to be a socialist to realize that. And, you know, when we talk about somebody being too big to fail as far as the banks or GM or whoever, I would counter that with saying you've resigned the mass of humanity to being too small to succeed. And I think that's where we stand right now, is that the great mass of Americans and certainly around the world are considered too small to succeed. And they're not given any kind of opportunities, and the disparity of wealth is such that, you know, when I was growing up in the 1960s, for instance, any job, and I mean any job, I knew lots of fathers of kids that were my friends that worked at the grocery stores or cashiers, that worked at Sears, Montgomery Ward's, just retail jobs, working behind a counter. That's, they supported a family. They owned a single-family home. They
That's right. There was a social contract. There was a social contract. And even Henry Ford recognize that if you the people that are working for you are your customers as well. They're going to buy your product. You better pay them a living wage. Otherwise, the whole thing falls apart. Donald Jeffries will stay with us. Survival of the Richest is the book. And we'll open up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour and get you to weigh in questions and comments. Here's Ike and Tina and their version of Get Back here on Coast to Coast AM.